Welcome back to Projector Room, the podcast where Gareth, Miles and myself talk about film, cinema and TV until you turn off your podcatcher and give up on us. Hello, Gareth.
I think they've given up on us already. Hello, Ted. How are you? What an exciting evening we're going to have, full of cinematic and televisual junk.
We will. And how are you?
Yeah, not too bad. Warm. It's quite hot here at the moment. I actually had to take my cardigan off.
Yeah.
Sitting over there.
Bleeding summer, isn't it?
I've got my summer cotton socks on. Not wool socks, cotton socks.
It started. I almost put my fan on today. No, I said, no, open the door a bit wider.
Oh, that's what I could have done. I could have turned. I've got one of those electric heaters, and it's got a fan mode, so I could have circulated the air.
Look, this is not Tech Addicts. We can't talk about the weather and the climate. That's got an exclusive on that. This is show 208, and it's slap bang central in the middle of April, and it really is. I said in February that we were on slap bang middle of February, and some friendly oik in the group pointed out that it wasn't, because February didn't have 30 days, and I was wrong. But this time, 30 days have September, April, June and November. So the 15th at midnight tonight will be in the middle of April.
But it's not right now.
No, that's true. So I'll probably still be told off. TedSalmon.com is where you can find me. GarethMiles.com is where you can find Gareth. I'm sucking a Weathers original, so I shouldn't have really put that in my mouth before we started. ProjectorRoom.co.uk is our website, where you'll find links to all the stuff that we are going to talk about on today's show. And of course, MeWe Group is where we hang out, and hopefully you do too, and we chat about film, cinema and TV over there too. But while I finish my Weathers original, you can take off with Fandom Focus. It's your turn.
Okie dokie. Well, you did a kids movie a while ago, and I thought, why not? You know, one of those movies that you were a fan of when you were a child.
Hmm.
And there's a little-known one that I was a big fan of. I wouldn't say it's known by too many people. It stars David Niven, Helen Hayes, Jodie Foster, and Leo McKern. And it's called Candleshoe. It's from that Disney factory of live action films that they used, or they made during the 60s and the 70s. And it was a film that it has a rather unique place in my life, because there are three films that my mother introduced me to. And purely by chance, she happened to record this one day off of television and told me that she recorded it and for me to watch it. So I did. She also did that with Used Cars. She recorded that one night when I was about 13 years old. And I can't thank her enough for doing that, because it's a great film with loads of tits in it. And she was none the wiser. She thought it was just like Smokey and the Bandit or The Cannonball Run, two films that have tits in them. But yes, she didn't know it was quite an adult film. This is not. This was purely, I think my mum was a big David Niven fan, and it was a curiosity that she'd wanted to see herself. I know she had a number of his books, and she recorded it, and I sat and watched it, and I enjoyed the pants off it. It's a very standard tale of kids running riot. They're in a foster home, which is this big old house that's run by Helen Hayes. And they're running out of money, and they need to get more money. And David Niven plays the butler, but he's also doubling as the gardener and the hunter or something like that. I can't remember what the other role is, but he plays three different roles with heavy disguises. And it's got, you know, fairly serviceable comedy in it. Jodie Foster is the young retrobate that is sent out to this house to be looked after by the orphanage, but she has some nefarious friends led by Leo McKern, who's a villain, and he's wanting to steal secret treasure that is apparently hidden somewhere in this big old dilapidated house. So Jodie Foster with all the other kids try to find the treasure, and the other kids eventually, and Helen Hayes, the elderly lady, win Jodie Foster over, and with the help of the swashbuckling butler played by Niven, they thwart the villains and have like a food fight at the end or something like that. I can't remember what. But I love this film, not because of the film itself, but because of the action climax where David Niven and Leo McKern do a bit of sword fighting on a staircase and things like that. And it was just that kind of daring do adventure that I lapped up. You cross that with a big old mansion that has secret passages and things like that, and they're constantly searching for this treasure that's hidden somewhere in this big old manor house. And it was just a fun time. I do remember the soundtrack being particularly good as well. And I do whistle some of the incidental music from it every now and again. And I have to go, what was that from again? Oh, yes, it's Candleshoe. So it's one of those movies that I have big love for, that I grew up with. And I showed it to my son whenever he was about 6 or 7, and he couldn't be less interested in it. He didn't like it at all, which was a bit disappointing. So I kind of, that was the last time I watched it, and it was a bit disheartening. But maybe one day I'll watch it again. I don't see Disney racing to re-release this on Blu-ray or 4K anytime. Well, that's because Disney don't do that generally. But I have the DVD sitting over there, and I quite like this film. Have you ever heard of it?
No, I have not. I'm watching the trailer kind of run while you're talking, and it'd be quite interesting to see. I'm not sure how old Jodie Foster is at this stage, but it'd be quite interesting to see what kind of actress she is at this stage in her, you know, growing career. Because of, you know, we've known her to grow older and be a very good actress. And it would just be interesting to see her back here, and which was the same as the little girl who lives down the lane. If you remember, we spoke about that before when she was younger. It's a bit worrying though that she keeps winking at everyone. That looks really creepy. I think it's a thing. My dad winks at everyone. I keep telling him it's creepy and don't do it. But I think it's something that, you know, post-war and 60s and 70s, probably people did lots of winking. Don't you think that's creepy?
I do, but I think winking's creepier when people do that. It's not something that I want to expose myself to. No, she was about 15 or 16 when she made this, and she...
Oh, right.
She's kind of that... she's like a tomboy.
Yeah.
A child that lives on the street, so she's a wee bit tougher and rougher, and it suits Jodie Foster very well playing that role. Mm-hmm. And to be honest, I think whenever I was a kid, I might not have really clocked that she was a girl. I don't think I noticed. I would probably be crucified for saying that or cancelled, but it's just something that didn't seem so obvious to me. And the other girl who's in it, Veronica Quiglin, she went on to something else as well that I noticed her in, and it took me a while. Papillon. Yeah, she's the Mother Superior in the recent version of Papillon. And I sat there for most of the movie going, who is she? Oh, yeah, but yes, it's a worthwhile watch if you've got some young kids. It's totally harmless. It's good fun, and David Niven does some ching ching at the end with Leo McKern, which is most welcome.
It looks lovely. I'm surprised, yeah. I haven't. It's pretty. It's like you said at the outset, really. It's what age you are and whether or not you get exposed to this stuff. And that was, you know, in 1977, I was 14, and, you know, listening to, or rather, what, you know, I'd seen Jaws by then, and you know, I was just not into the kind of kid thing, and I've never gone back to it, I suppose. Anyway, yeah, good pick, and one day I might watch it. It looks very, very charming indeed.
Twee. It's very twee.
Yeah. Very nice fandom focus indeed. Right, let's get to private screening. Now, last time, I challenged the panel to watch a bit of, well, myself as well, because I'd seen the first episode of Something Very Bad Is Going to Happen on Netflix, and I thought it had potential. It's had 8 episodes. All of them were kind of, you know, the usual 41 minutes long or 42 minutes. I thought it looked okay. So I decided to challenge us with it. I've since discovered that 4 of the episodes have been directed by the Polish woman who did Baby Reindeer. We talked about Baby Reindeer on the show, and I think Alan and I probably liked it, and you weren't so keen, if I remember correctly. But I thought that Baby Reindeer was really good. Veronica Tofilska, and she directed the first 2 episodes and the last 2 episodes of this 8. And she was also the executive producer as well. So she was obviously very much tied up in it. Camilla Moroni, who I'd never heard of, I'm afraid, and Adam DiMarco play the two leads. But my interest was kind of sharpened by seeing Ted Levine and Jennifer Jason Leigh in it. Now, the pair of them across the 8 episodes didn't have a huge amount of screen time. I think they were, you know, they were the paid names, if you like, the paid actors to give it its kudos. And it was, I found, I'll go first and say, I found that after the first 3 episodes, it was, I almost gave up on it. And it's interesting that someone in the MeWe group said the same thing. And I said to him, don't give up, because actually in episode 4, it really comes to life, and it does. Stuff starts happening. And you think after 3 episodes, what on earth is going on here? And you can't put the pieces of the jigsaw together at all. But in episode 4, it all comes together. It all makes sense. And I suddenly got renewed enthusiasm to go on. And I did. And I watched it all in the end. The acting is very good. Camilla Moroni, or Marone, in the lead is really good. And it's always great to see Jennifer Jason Leigh, even though she wasn't playing a huge part in this. Ted Levine plays the patriarch of this family that it's centred around. Incidentally, when I got to episode 7, he had a bit of a monologue going on, and I suddenly twigged who he sounded like. He sounded like James Gum, of course, from The Silence of the Lambs, because he played him. But then I realised it also, he sounds like Chris in Family Guy. I don't know whether the Family Guy makers, Seth Watsit, have done that on purpose, but it just sounds exactly like James Gum, and I'm watching Family Guy with renewed interest now to listen to James Gum talking. But it's very dark and mysterious. It's about this woman who is going to get married to this guy who is, it comes from this rich family, basically, and they live in the middle of nowhere, and they're going to have the wedding in this house in the middle of nowhere, and it's all about the week leading up to this, and strange things happen on the way. We find out bits and pieces, one of which is that her mother had died on her wedding day, and all of this, that's not a particularly bad spoiler, because the whole of this kind of centres around what happened to Camilla Marone's mother on her wedding day, and it starts to get a bit ghost story-ish, and supernatural stuff starts to come in, and it heads on. I think it was a bit drawn out in the end. I think it could have probably been done in 5 or 6 episodes. Certainly the episodes leading up to episode 4, the first 3, I think they could have been shortened a bit, really, to keep people in there, because I could easily have given up. But The whole thing, I think, is made really well. The acting is really good by everyone. The camera works good. The storytelling is really good. It's a really interesting original idea. And no spoilers here, but there's lots of twists and turns going on, especially in the finale. So episodes 7 and 8 are just absolutely worth waiting for. Really, really good finale. And it's just completely bonkers in the end, and it's interesting. It's character rich throughout, I thought. Yeah, absolutely. I don't think it was brilliant, as some things are, but I think it's really, really watchable and really well done. And they've obviously, the story writers have done it really well, and they've put the twists and turns in, and the hooks into the characters and the background, and they've paced out the reveals really well as it goes forward. Yeah, I really liked it, and I thought it was a well worth watching. I watched all 8. How far did you get?
Well, I did 1 episode last night. I've had a busy week, but I couldn't quite remember what we thought of it from when we did it in Coming Soon. But we watched the trailer before it started, and to be quite honest, I couldn't think of anything worse than watching it last night. I was like, oh, I just want to watch something like The Rookie and go to bed. So I went into it not wanting to see it. And by gum, did it win me over in the first 20 minutes. The relationship between Camille and or Rachel, the character of Rachel, yeah, and her fiancé, Nikki, mm-hmm, it was so well written. Mm-hmm. Their characters were relatable. They were funny. They were interesting. And I thoroughly enjoyed their interactions, you know, even when they were just sharing pie and listening to them talk about things. I could have listened for a while. I cared. Mm-hmm. And it's absolutely to do the strength of their performances is what hooked me in there. Whenever they got to the house, I did feel a wee bit uncomfortable in that, you know, they've got to the house and they haven't sort of introduced themselves or walked in and gone, hello, is anyone here? And it kind of, I felt that it was artificially creating tension where anyone else who had walked into the house would have had a look about to see who's there, just to let people know that we've arrived, not just slipped off to a bedroom to unpack and leaving his fiancée to go and get some ice for his face, knowing full well that his weird family could be further on in the house. And it made me think, is that quite as good? But given the strength of the first half of that episode, I sat with it. The bar scene was fantastic as well. It was an exercise in tension as you see things in the background and you're waiting for things to happen. And the reactions were, I feel, human. So I have the next episode to watch tonight, and I'm very much looking forward to it. I will see this through. The one thing that I've seen people compare it to American Horror Story online, saying it's if you like that, try this. And I'd actually say, no, it's not American Horror Story. Don't get me wrong, I quite liked American Horror Story, but I found it too complicated to sit back and enjoy. You had to be thinking about what was going on because the plots got more and more complex as the seasons went on. And if you stopped concentrating for a minute, you'd be lost. This feels a lot less demanding concentration-wise, which, you know, I don't like to concentrate when I come home from work because I've been concentrating all day. So I prefer to take my brain out, and this just worked. I hope it doesn't get too complex as it goes on, but I've got a funny feeling that it's nicely layered where there's enough intrigue to keep you going, and then it'll have enough surprises to keep you entertained as we go on. And from what you're saying, it sounds like that it is a nicely balanced experience going through.
It certainly turns on episode 4, so don't give up before you get to 4, because that's where it starts to, you know, layer it out, and you it starts to make sense. Make sure you get to that.
Yeah. No, I will do. I'm looking forward to watching an episode as soon as I get done with this bloody show.
There's also the only thing I was going to say was it's a good job that Alan's not here, because the fuck word is used liberally by everyone, and it just feels like it's a bit unnatural. It's not used in someone kind of as an expletive or peppering something because they're angry. It's just used in everyday comes out, like pass the fucking cheese, will you? When you watch it, you'll suddenly realise that I don't know why that they felt the need to do that, peppering the whole. It just feels a bit false and a bit silly.
I'd say it's probably more realistic. You know, I've recently changed jobs and I've moved out to somewhere where I'm not around the educated folk, I dare say, and there's a lot of people who tend to use the big F-bomb more liberally to describe everything, because it's a word that works for adjective, noun and verb depending on how you want to. So I've noticed in the last couple of weeks that word is featuring a great deal more from where I was before. Not educated, sorry, that's the wrong way to do it. I knew it was wrong whenever it was coming out, but it just advanced out of my mouth because I'm a fuckwit. Politically correct and better behaved people, whereas now I'm with worse behaved people. the F word does flew.
But even taking into account, you wouldn't be sitting at a dinner table and say casually, "Pass the fucking cheese, will you?" I don't think even people I'm being careful what I say now. I don't buy that anyone really would do that, just peppering it with ordinary sentences. It's got to be something. Fair enough if you're saying move out the fucking way, you know, but not anyway. Perhaps I'm wrong.
Would that not be indicative of a family that's kind of lost their footing with each other, where there's a father who hasn't, in the typical role model, who hasn't, you know, taught his kids not to do that and treat each other with respect, and a mother who hasn't stepped in and you know, wooden spooned them for using such an expletive. I think that's telling of the type of family that's working here. Whereas, you know, even something like Roseanne, they didn't swear constantly at each other, even though they were narcissistic and mean to each other throughout the running of that show, but they still had those family principles that they would try to instill in their kids. I still wouldn't swear in front of my mother, although I've noticed since the passing of my father, my mother likes to swear a great deal more.
But this family are educated and they're well to do, and you can argue that they're posh even. You know, these are not gutter snipes. These are educated people. So it just, and that's why it didn't fit, because even mum and dad were doing the same thing. It was the culture of the family, and it just didn't fit. I'm sorry. I've spent time in my life with well-to-do, posh families, and that just doesn't happen. But maybe it does now. Perhaps the world is changing. Anyway, enough of that. I'm going to score it 12 out of 15, because I thought it was very good, and I have seen the whole lot, and I really enjoyed it, and I thought it was worth it. So what are you going to score it?
Well, I'll go with 10, and I would like to ask one question that some might say is a touch of a spoiler, but do you believe that there might be a season 2, or is it's been advertised as a limited series, But I'm thinking that it is getting a lot of press at the moment, so I think that they would be mad not to try to shoehorn something else into this brand that is now there.
When you watch the last episode, you will realise that absolutely it could be going on to season two.
Okay, right, okay. So it's not so limited.
No.
Okie doke.
So you're going to give it what? 10.
10.
So that makes it 22. That puts it in the territory of The Lost Bus. Oh, yeah.
and Baby Reindeer.
Baby Reindeer. That's spooky, isn't it? And that's about a third of the way down the table, I suppose. Or maybe a quarter of the way. Yeah. In the top 25%, I would say. So, yeah, I think that was a good pick. And I was pleased we did it. And I might even watch Baby Reindeer again now. So anyway, right, your turn for the next show. What are we going to watch?
Okay, well, I had noticed that it had popped up on streaming for folks to enjoy, and we featured it in Coming Soon, some weeks ago. Capture from 2026. This is it's kind of a found footage film, but I wouldn't say that it is a found footage film. It's about someone who finds footage in a traditional storytelling way and then reviews the found footage to discover the horrors of her parents.
Okay. I don't remember watching this trailer. We did this in Coming Soon, did we? Oh, yeah. Yeah. I'm seeing it now. Yeah, that looks all right. Yeah, I'm up
she
for that.
She inherits a house, and she goes up the stairs and discovers there's a weird room. She's advised by everyone in the town not to go to the house, and she finds a video camera at the end of a bed or something like that.
Say
she
no
goes and
more.
Has a look to see what's on the video camera and discovers that they have been doing puppet shows. Not puppet shows, but something like that.
Say no more. Right, okay, Capture it is for the next show. So let us know what you think of that too. And we'll move into themed treats. And it was your choice for picking a theme for this show. What was it?
Well, I went with beer. Beer. Good old-fashioned beer. Mm-hmm. Oh, I think my mother's ears must have been burning. She's fooling me at the moment, but it's okay. I'll just mute the call because it's her heating system. That's all.
Okay.
She's not getting used to it. And it's only been 10 years. Right. I figured beer. And I'm going to start by suggesting Shaun of the Dead, where they take the car, go to Mum's, kill Phil, grab Liz, and go down to the Winchester for a nice cold pint and wait for it all to blow over. Shaun of the Dead is obviously a classic comedy zombie movie with that kind of pub-going mentality attached to it. You know it well?
I don't know it well, but I have seen it, and I think I've seen it twice. And yes, it's jolly good fun. And I know that Alan was a big fan as well. So, yeah, I couldn't have sworn to remembering that they went drinking beers, but I did think it was a good film.
All right, okay. And there's also Men Behave Badly, a TV show that I have gone on about for years. It was the first sitcom that I really felt I loved back in the late 80s, early 90s. As it was sort of drawing to a close, I kind of got into it. I looked forward to it being on TV, and I was always hoping for a new season to be announced. And I just liked the idea, not so much of them being larger lights, but the idea that pretty much every episode kind of ends with the two leads sitting on their couch with a tin of Stella reflecting on their adventures from the day. And I like that idea. Whenever you're growing older, maybe living on your own or living with a roommate, you wish that you had that kind of level of companionship and you're able just to sort of summarize the day in a diary sort of way to round it off. And I always liked it. But the main thing I wanted to talk about beer-wise is the classic 1983 comedy from Canada, Strange Brew, with Rick Moranis and Dave Thomas from SCTV. It was their big happening. It was a relatively low-budget comedy that's stupid. I'm not gonna try and dress it up as anything other, because they know how stupid it is, and everyone who's seen it knows how stupid it is. But it is just genuinely stupid, and it's about a couple of guys who manage to, well, they annoy their father, and they end up getting a job in a beer company, a brewing company, and discover a plot to mind control the world or something like that. I can't quite remember. It's been a while since I've seen it. But it's just stupidly funny. It's a bit dated now, but you can imagine back in 1983, whenever this arrived, it was just something so wacky and out there that it became one of those things. Have you seen this? This is crazy. And that's the way it came to me. Like, oh, we got it. You haven't seen Strange Brew. We have to watch Strange Brew. And it was put on for me at a party. And I sat there and I giggled throughout. And the Rick Moranis became a legend to me, because I was like, that's the guy from Ghostbusters and Honey, I Shrunk the Kid. Maybe he hadn't made that at the time. Possibly had. And Dave Thomas, who isn't quite as well known, but whenever you see him in things, you'll go, ah, yes, and I know him, yes, very well. Max von Sydow plays the Brewmeister General, or whatever his name is, which is, you know, such great casting. They got Father Merrin from The Exorcist in to play this role, and he played Blofeld in Never Say Never Again. And then Paul Dooley's in there as another character as well. It's just a fantastic little comedy that has, I don't think too many people have seen it. I don't think it gets too many rave, or doesn't make it onto too many greatest comedies ever made lists, but it should be there. It really is quality. Have you seen it?
I haven't, but I'm watching the trailer run through, and it actually, I'm as you know, I'm the first one to down American comedies, but
it's Canadian.
Okay, I noticed that you made that point right at the outset to put me off.
To try and draw you in, because I didn't say I was American. I know how you feel about American.
What I meant was to put me off my track. Anyway, I have been looking at this as you've been talking, and actually, I think it looks quite funny. One of the reasons is that Rick Moranis I do like, and I only really know him from the musical, which I now can't remember the name of. Little Shop of Horrors. And that's when I first became aware of him, and I thought he was brilliant in that. I don't think I've seen but Ghostbusters, not right the way through anyway, and I haven't seen those other ones you've said, so that's the only place I know him from. But in this role, do you know what? And you never thought I'd say this. I might go and track this down and watch it, because I think it looks quite good fun. So there you are.
Yeah. I think you should, and then follow it up with My Blue Heaven, which is another great Rick Moranis comedy with Steve Martin. It's kind of some people say it's the sequel to Goodfellas, because it follows on the Harry Hill story from where Goodfellas leaves off, but it's a comedy, so it's, yeah, those two, great double bill for you.
Cool, okay. Well, I'll do the TV first, which is Cheers, which in which Norm is always drinking beer and everyone else at the bar, which is really, really funny. Of course, we've spoken about Cheers lots of times on the show before, and we're all great fans, well, both now. And it's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. Well, it's set in a bar, and it's really funny throughout. It's not particularly necessarily about beer, but there's beer everywhere in it, obviously. And it's just a comedy show that we've gone back to, and we all have appreciated. Think it's really funny, particularly with Danny DeVito. What he does, that just makes it for me. And Bottom, you know, they were always in the two seasons of Bottom. They were always down at the Lamb and Flag and causing trouble, and there's always something going on to do with the pub. The Lamb and Flag at Hammersmith, so the pair of them in Bottom, which was just great. So those are my.
Is there a Lamb and Flag?
What, in a real one?
Yeah,
I don't think so. No.
Okay.
I think it was made up, because actually, if you dig into the background of it, the outside shots of the Lamb and Flag, they've got photographs of the pub that they use for that.
Right.
So it can't be, I don't think. So those are my three TV ones, really. And I know that you agree with all three of them, because, we've spoken about them all before. But the one I wanted to retain for last was a film which we both appreciate, and you probably more than me, Ice Cold and Alex, 1958 film, which I haven't seen for ages. However, I did roll some of the highlights through just the other day to remind myself. And at the end of this highlights reel, they showed Alec, John Mills at the end of it, in Alex drinking this beer. And it reminded me of this. You can give the background of the story in a second, because you know it so well. But it reminded me of that moment, that where he was sat at the bar just looking at this glass, and the condensation, that the hot climate, and the droplets of water are going down the outside, and he sits there for a long time, and then he suddenly wolfs it back in one.
Yeah.
So that's the beer. But yeah, give us the lowdown, because you're a big fan.
Well, yeah, it's John Mills, isn't it? John Mills, yeah. And his motley crew of medical officers, I think they are. They've got to try and get this ambulance across the Sahara.
To Egypt. I think they've got to get to Egypt, haven't they? Well, to Alex.
Okay.
To Alexandria.
Alexandria. That's right, yes. Hence the title. Yeah. They're pushing essentially this ambulance over the dunes and things, and it's a story of hot, sticky, hard work, where it's just devastating as the film goes on. You know, they push the ambulance up a dune, and as they're just getting to the top, they're about to get it over, and it rolls all the way back down. And they've got to start over again in the searing heat, and it's the greatest advert for it's the greatest advert for Carlsberg that's ever been known. Yeah. Because even there's a great challenge that you can do with this film, which is, you know, if you've got a long week ahead of you, you've got something very arduous to do, you do that, and then you sit down with your buddies and you watch this. And you sit through the whole movie, and you have a beer in front of you, and you don't touch that beer until John Mills drinks the beer. And it's worth it. You just get a taste of just how wonderful that beer is for the captain of the group. Having a quick look at the cast there, you know, you've got Anthony Quayle, John Mills, Harry Andrews, and Richard Marner from Allo Allo, if you know him as well. It's a wonderful film, absolutely wonderful, and it's as a classic. Anyone who's watched it really just knows how impactful that is, and how thirsty you get.
Richard Marner was the, he was the big fat German, wasn't he? Yeah, I'm with you now.
Lovely.
Right. So, Sylvia Sims, who was just lovely throughout.
Right.
Anthony Quayle, he played the kind of drunk, didn't he? The guy that was trying to not drink, and then all the gin turns up, and he turns around and drinks it all. I think that was Captain Van der Poel. I think that was his character.
I don't quite remember that bit as well. It's been a while since I've seen it, but
But it was that last scene, of him sat at the bar. It's worth just watching it for that, if nothing else, because if you soak up the atmosphere, and it's obvious, the atmosphere is obvious, because it's where it's set in Egypt, and it's hot, and there's this lovely cool beer there. And yeah,
well, and this is a film that I'm actually saving for the first time I give my son a beer. We're going to watch this, and he's going to have his beer at the same time as John Milnes. He'll hate it, like, but yeah. If I can control that, I'd like to.
Yeah. So there you go, then. Beer was your theme. My theme for the next show is going to be something we haven't focused on before that I can remember, which is firefighters. And we probably know between us loads of films and TV shows that centre around firefighters, or firemen, as we call them here. I'm in Blighty, and I'm sure we can come up with some options on that, can't we?
We can indeed. I've thought of a few, but you're probably going to steal them.
Well, you've got to get in early, you see. There's your motivation. Let's get to the main feature. I'm going to talk about The Strangers. The Strangers, because The Strangers Chapter 3 just dropped into streaming services last week. And it kind of made up the trilogy of the three. The first thing to say is that Chapter 1, Chapter 2 and Chapter 3 could really have been made into like a 5-hour film. I mean, it's a real trilogy, because basically when one finishes, the other one starts. It just carries on the story. It could have been made a mini-series or a long film or whatever. But the characters, the plot, the storyline, those that survive anyway, are on the next film, and the story goes forward. And we've spoken about the first one before, where this couple, in fact, it was made on the back of a 2008 film, wasn't it?
It's a remake, yeah.
Yeah, it's a remake of that one. And I think we spoke about the 2008 film before on the show, which was really good. But this one is, as I say, a trilogy. So in part one, this couple, in the same way as in the 2008 film, turn up at this house, and they have to stay somewhere because the locals have sabotaged their car and blah, 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 blah. And then these three Fruit Loops with masks on and a sackcloth face covering, the Scarecrow, just basically terrorize them. And in the end, I don't know whether we should be giving spoilers here or not. I'll try not to. So whoever survives from the end of that first film goes into Chapter 2. And in Chapter 2, actually, there's a really interesting... I'll have to spoil it to some degree to say that the girl in the first one, Maya, wakes up in the hospital. So you know she survives. And the three Fruit Loops, who are incidentally called Dollface, Pinup Girl and Scarecrow, they find out that this girl has survived, and so they need to go and finish the job, basically. So the second one is a long chase. I think actually the second one's probably the best one. There's a sequence in the hospital where she gets out of her bedroom. The three of them are rampaging through the hospital to find her. And this scene in the hospital actually reminded me an awful lot. I don't know if you remember the museum scene in The Last of Us. So I think it was in the second episode of The Last of Us. Mm-hmm. And we talked about it on the show, and there's this sequence on there, really long sequence, where it's really eerie and quiet, and they're creeping through this museum to get up the stairs and out the back and all the rest of it. Well, this sequence in the second part of the Chapter 2 of The Strangers is actually much like that. It's really silent. They use the silence of the situation really well, and it builds suspense. And an extraordinary long time we're with her creeping through this hospital, and it works really well. So at the end of the second chapter, which, I can't give spoilers, but the third chapter begins with the end of the second one. And in actual fact, during the part of the second one and the third one, we do find out more about these three characters, particularly Pinup Girl, and why she's like she is, and who Scarecrow is. Well, we find out who Scarecrow is at the very end. but we find out who's the other characters in the town and how they fit in with the Dollface and Pinup Girl and Scarecrow and why they're like they are, and we get flashbacks to their childhood and how that panned out for them and childhood jealousies and blah blah blah, and it all kind of makes sense. They've kind of stitched it together quite well, and in the end you have more idea about what's going on. And our central character Maya is at the hub of this. She's the main character. She's the main what's her actress name? I can't remember now. It's here somewhere.
Her last name's quite exotic, isn't it? It's Marlene.
That's the one, yeah. But she's clearly the star of the show throughout, really, and she's in every scene. And some of the chase scenes, when the three masked characters are chasing her outside the hospital, they get out of the hospital and they're chasing her across the woodland, and she's got to try and hide and escape, and they're leaping from one disaster to a next and trying to not get wiped out. There is some violence in it. A lot of the violence is done in such a way that you don't kind of see too much, but you see the aftermath of it more. But there is violence and blood and gore and stuff in it throughout. I think it's more... What I put in my review of this was that it's more of a terror than a horror for me, because all three of them are about people being terrorized by these three Fruit Loops, and the tension builds and the especially in the second one, I think. Do have a look at it. It's there's her name, Pesh.
Yeah.
Madeline
Pesh.
Yeah, it's actually quite an enjoyable romp and a good watch. It certainly isn't Little House on the Prairie, but it's dark and suspenseful and terrifying at times, and I think they did quite a good job with the suspense as well. So worth a look, even though it's a kind of slasher kind of film. I think it's kind of a bit of a cut above. Have you seen all of them or any of them?
I haven't seen any of this new trilogy. I've seen the original and that lesser sequel. Have you seen those two? How do these compare to those other two?
I think that I haven't seen I've seen the 2008 film that we spoke about just now. I haven't seen anything else, but I did think that I thought the 2008 film was much more polished in terms of production values. I think they spent more money on it, and the acting was really, really good in that. And I thought that they moved away from that into a pure kind of slasher thing here. But I think it's still done quite a good job. But there's one in between, is there?
Yeah, there was like a direct-to-video sequel to the 2008 one, Strangers Pray at Night, I think it was called.
Oh, okay. No, I've not seen that.
I can't remember anything about it, but I remember thinking it was a bit meh. I don't think it was terrible or anything. I didn't walk away from it going, I'm never watching that again. Just thought it was more of the same.
Yeah. And you might think the same of this trilogy. You might think it's just more of the same, but I think particularly in the second one, it's that they've kind of they've made it pretty good.
Yeah. Okay. So it's worth checking out. I've heard some mixed reports about the whole trilogy and how it might have just been better being one or possibly two films, and it's a bit stretched.
Yeah, maybe, but it worked okay for me. And before I hand over to you, I'm just going to mention, I said on the last show that it would be a really good idea for us to focus a bit on some of these Oscar-winning shorts. And so I did. I tracked one down. This one is called The Girl Who Cried Pearls. And it was actually a really good little 17-minute short, really thoughtful. It's about this girl who lives in poverty, and she starts crying because she's so sad because her family mistreat her. And when she cries pearls. And this guy next door, equally poor, collects some of these pearls, goes to a pawnbroker, starts to make money out of it. And so the moral of the whole story is about making sure that the girl stays sad and cries so that everyone can make money out of it. And that's the social dilemma. Whereas what the boy wants really is to be happy and to be with this girl, but the draw of the money from the pearls is just too much. And it's a stop motion animation. It's really, really nicely made. And you can track that down on, where did I see it? Oh, yes. Yeah, it's this thing I'd never heard of called Arte, A-R-T-E.
Okay.
I've got a link in my review to it. And it's Arte.tv. Never heard of it, but it's there anyway. And if people want to watch it, they can. 17 minutes. Very nice.
Grand. Okay. Oscar winner at that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You want me to go now? Or?
Yeah, go on.
All right.
We'll do a sandwich.
Oh, right. Okay. I'll start with a film that I have wanted to see for a long time. It's taken me a while to actually get around to it, but it was released on Blu-ray some time ago, and I picked it up, and I finally got it on. And as you were talking about earlier, the F-bomb does appear quite frequently in it, and my wife went, "I'm done with this," and she got up and left the room because it was ridiculous how often it happened at the start of this film. But One False Move is a 1991 police procedural thriller starring Bill Paxton, Billy Bob Thornton,
whoa,
and Cinda Williams, Michael Beach. That's right, yeah, Michael Beach. I was trying to work out where I knew him from, but he was in The Rookie for a while. And it's really just a, you know, a tense, often slightly humorous little slice of police drama about some violent criminals who are on their way down to a particular area in Texas, and the sheriff has been notified, or the chief, sorry, Chief Dale Hurricane Dixon, Bill Paxton, has been notified by the FBI that these guys are coming his way, and he has to kind of prepare for them. And the FBI managed to get some agents there first to prepare for the arrival of these guys, find them and take them down. And Bill Paxton plays this kind of, you know, small town sheriff who wants a shot at the big time, and this is the most exciting thing that's ever happened to him. So he's mustard keen to get in on the action. And the FBI, when they arrive, played by Jim Metzler and Earl Billings, they are initially somewhat impressed by him and his hospitality, but and end up taking the piss out of him because he's a country bumpkin sort of cop, and he overhears this, and it causes a bit of a dynamic between the two of them. But the whole thing just builds as a, it doesn't seem like it's really going anywhere. It's just investigating these characters, but it builds to a really striking climax where, you know, it's one set of characters versus another set of characters. And along the way, you know what, after it was over, I was like, did I like that? I wasn't quite sure if I did, because it felt somewhat uneventful. It felt like I hadn't sort of taken anything away from it. But over the next few days, I was thinking about it just a bit more, and the exchanges that happened between them and the characters that they established, and I realized just how much I cared and how much I liked Bill Paxton's character, how much I hated Billy Bob Thornton's character. And it had a delayed reaction on me, and it was quite bizarre how that happens. Have you ever heard of this film?
No, I haven't, but I'm quite drawn to it because I can't believe how young Billy Bob Thornton looks in there. In fact, he looks a bit like Peter Sutcliffe, actually, which is a bit of a shame. But watching the trailer rolling, it actually does look quite good, I have to say. And the way you've spoken about it, it sounds like it's something that I should track down. Yeah.
Well, it puts me in the mind of, Bill Paxton, Billy Bob Thornton made a number of films together that did A Simple Plan, and there was another one that was on the tip of my tongue.
That was brilliant.
This kind of feels like A Simple Plan.
Mm-hmm.
It's in that wheelhouse, but it's not similar. It feels like that. And there was a Matthew McConaughey film as well called Lone Star. It feels very much like that as well. It's just, you know, that kind of Texan Dust Bowl cop thriller with larger-than-life personalities and not much of a story to tell, so it just investigates the characters. It's a terrific character piece, absolutely brilliant. The director, Carl Franklin, he went on to a number of other films which were really good as well. He did Devil in a Blue Dress with Denzel and Out of Time with Denzel, if you know those two films, which are rather good. There was a bunch of other, you did Ray Donovan and things like that, and what was it, Morgan Freeman, High Crimes film, wasn't it, High Crimes with not Angelina Jolie, Ashley Judd, that's what it was. Those films were really good, really, you know, solid thrillers, and this is kind of where he came from. This was his first big hit that got people's attention and got him all those other films. And I've just noticed one that looks really quite good called Full Fathom 5, which he directed too. I might give that a go if I can find it. Yeah. It's worth checking out. If you've seen it, you probably know what I'm talking about, because this thing is really quite good. It's not amazing. You're not going to think, it's not like Lone Star where it is genre defining, but it feels like Lone Star. It's about the closest you're going to get. Yeah,
cool.
So the other film, and I'm not going to go too on too long because I think most people know what this is about, is Send Help, directed by Sam Raimi. This is kind of Cast Away with a wee bit of a humorous approach to it. And in mid-film, things get turned on their head, where Rachel McAdams plays a very put-upon employee of Dylan O'Brien's CEO character's company, and together the two are plane crashed on an island, not shipwrecked, plane crashed on an island, and they have to learn to survive. But Rachel McAdams' character has the has experience of applying for the show Survivor, where she wants to be on that show. So she reads books about how to survive in the wild, and it's the perfect excuse for her to put those actions, or to put those theories into actions, and she does so. But the CEO still thinks that he's her boss, and the two have a bit of a falling out, shall we say. And it's got lots of plot twists along the way. I don't think you're really going to work out exactly what happens in the end from the film, but you might guess a few of the things that are going to crop up, because there are multiple things that happen at the end, because it's quite a layered thriller adventure romance, I suppose, it's worth throwing in there as well, with some horror peppered through it as well, and a bit of gruesome bloodshed, and a few beefy laughs. This is Sam Raimi, after all, so it has a sense of humour about itself. It's very much worth checking out. I really liked it. It's not brilliant by any stretch of the imaginations, much like One False Move, but it is. It's just another solid Sam Raimi horror film that's a wee bit different, and it's much, much better than that one with Madonna that does something similar. Swept Away, was it? Have you seen this yet?
I have, and I wasn't really impressed, to be honest. It started off as a kind of tedious American rom-com, really, which you just alluded to some degree. And yeah, there was some gore thrown in here and there, but I did, unlike you, I did think that the end was fairly predictable, and it was all right. I'm not saying that it was flop of the fortnight material, but certainly the first 20 minutes before the plane crash was just tedious, and I was skipping past it because it was so boring. We know what the setup was. We know what the interesting bit was when the plane crashed and they got to the island, and then, as you said earlier, when it starts to the twists come out for those that are not watching properly and don't think about things to be surprised by.
So you missed Bruce Campbell then?
I wouldn't have known him if I'd seen him.
What's the matter with you?
I'm not Gary.
Can you believe this? Yeah, it's got a Bruce connection. And pat yourself on your back on the back if you got it.
Then I shall not. No,
and
I wasn't.
The classic is in there too.
Sorry.
The classic is in there too.
The classic? What's the classic?
Yeah. Oh, you don't care. You're not a Sam Raimi fan.
Okay. I wasn't impressed by that film anyway. No. It was all right, but I just wasn't, it was all right. That's all. It's all right. That's all. I was quite impressed with Heel. Heel is a kind of British film which has been lurking around and difficult to get hold of, but I managed to track it down in the end. And it's about this guy who behaves very badly in public, in terms of his social media and all the rest of it. And suddenly this little family of mum, dad and son decide to kidnap him. And so they drug him and chuck him in a van, and then take him to their house, which is in the middle of nowhere in the Yorkshire Moors somewhere, and they basically chain him up in the cellar. And the rest of the film really is about them trying to deprogram him to break him out of his unsociable, unkind, unfriendly, nasty behaviour that he's been indulging in for so long. And it's done really well. There's some surprises at the end. There's an interesting process of the behavioural process that you'd expect to see in terms of psychology when people are being broken, I suppose. And it's entertaining as well, and it's certainly worth a watch. So there's that. Red Riding I was drawn to because of the connotations with Red Riding Hood, of course, and it's a slasher kind of pick, and that was really good fun as well. It's a bit different. It's about this girl who lives in London. Her mum dies and she's going to be taken into care unless she finds somewhere to live, so she finds the only living relative, who's a really rich woman who's got this huge estate in Scotland, goes to live up on this estate in Scotland. The family name is Riding, and her name is Redell, I think it is. And so she's known as Red. She goes up to stay with the woman in Scotland, and everything is not quite as it seems. And her mum had half an arm, which she said that a wolf up there had bitten off. But everyone else up there said, no, it was a car accident. And so lots of local characters and deception going on, and you watch it unfold, and that's quite good as well. On a similar, a kind of similar vein, I suppose, is the 2026 film Thrash, which you might approve of, which is a shark film, whereby there's an East Coast town, there's a hurricane, and there's an East Coast America town, and this hurricane is bringing in this water into this town, and Most people decide to evacuate and some don't or can't, and we follow the stories of those that don't or can't. The whole town is covered in about 12 foot of water. People are trapped. Disaster and adventure follows disaster and adventure. And to top it all, in the middle of all this, there are six sharks that find their way in and start to terrorize the survivors. And so there is some gore in it, but much like I was saying earlier, a lot of the gore is kind of left to your imagination to some degree. The footage of the sharks is not badly done, the CGI bits. I think the CGI bits of the town flooding was actually very good. That was done quite well. Reminded me actually of that film, was it Rain? Or The Rain or something? Where a town was flooded and they were trying...
Hard Rain,
was it? Yeah. I think it reminded me a lot of that film. And
the effects were really bad then.
Right, okay. So the effects in Thrash were actually not that bad. They were actually, you know... But where they could have been bad, they kind of kept away from doing them at all, if you follow. So they just kind of said, no, we won't try and make that, because with the budget we've got, we probably won't do it very well, so we'll leave it alone. But yeah, that's worth it. For the person who likes a shark, loony shark film, I think that they'll quite enjoy Thrash. And that's on Netflix now, so you can grab that one. And lastly, I come to the Bride, which everyone has completely slated. If you go to IMDb, that's getting zero scores from everyone virtually, and I just don't get it, because I watched this film and I thought it looked great and I really, really enjoyed the story. Now you could argue that Jesse Buckley could do no wrong, and so I was destined to like it anyway. I do think the weakest link probably was Christian Bale, who was just not very convincing, but anyway, it's all set in the 1930s, and it's about this Frankenstein character, played by Bale, who goes to this woman, mad scientist, in America, and gets her to try and make him a partner. It just so happens that this off-the-wall Jesse Buckley character... called Ida has just died, so they go and dig her up, and she's reborn as Penelope, and becomes his partner, exactly what he wanted. But after that, they are uncontrolled, and someone tries to rape her, and so the pair of them end up killing these two guys, and they go on the run. And at that point in the film, it kind of turns into a 1930s Bonnie and Clyde type film, and they go from place to place just causing absolute chaos and mayhem, no rules, very, very Bonnie and Clyde, and they're just kind of bonkers, the pair of them. Hot on their heels are these two coppers, played by Peter Sarsgaard and Penelope Cruz. And Penelope Cruz is just, apparently she's 51. I thought she was older than that, but anyway, apparently she's 51, and she stole every scene she was in, to be honest. She was, you know, she was, if she'd been in it more, she would have nicked it from Jesse Buckley for sure. And she did really well. But anyway, these two coppers go in chase of the two Fruit Loops. And it goes from bad to worse, and I won't tell you the ending, but it works out really nicely. The cinematography is really good. It gets the era perfectly, I think, with the vehicles and the wardrobe and the whole design of the sets and everything. The music is really, really nice. Apparently, Jake Gyllenhaal, who's also has a small part in the film, did some of the music, and he is the he's related to the director Gyllenhaal, Maggie Gyllenhaal. Yeah, that's right. So he's a musician. I didn't know that, and he's created quite a lot of the music for the film. And, you know, that just added to the whole thing. And it was, it's just really, really well done. And the Bonnie and Clyde thing kicks into overdrive when people in the public are getting to know what they were doing. A bit like Natural Born Killers, you know, and people were copying them. And Jesse Buckley's character has got this kind of splash of black stuff on her face, and people were painting that on their faces and trying to copy what was going on, and kind of making them famous. And very, very Bonnie and Clyde. Anyway, Bonnie and Clyde. Really, really good film. I really don't get why it's got such bad press. I thought it was really, really enjoyable, really well acted, really well produced, and just really well done. I don't get it. You must watch it and tell me what you think and see if you agree with me or everyone else in the world.
Sure, yeah. It's not my bag, I don't think. But I'll maybe give it a go. I think my wife has made rumblings about watching it, so I might have to.
You sound almost as enthusiastic as you were approaching something very bad is going to happen.
True. Yeah, I suppose. Yeah. I can't be so generic about it. Yeah,
anyway, okay. That was my little clutch of stuff that I've been watching. And I've been enjoying myself, actually. I quite like my little group of stuff. So there it is. What is coming soon?
All right. Well, we'll start with the first one, because starting with the last one would be silly. Dirty Hands is coming to Video On Demand, Direct-to-Video On Demand, on the 24th of April. This is a new action thriller when a routine drug deal goes bad, the Denton brothers must fight for their lives if they're going to survive to see the next day. This looks like a fairly cheap action film with Patrick Muldoon, Kevin Interdonato, Michael Beach again, and Denise Richards. I don't have high hopes for it, but to be honest, the trailer just looked pretty good. It looks like a fairly lively and intense little action film. What do you make of it?
I'm sure people that like lively and intense action films will love it. But for me, it's just more of the whole kind of macho man, guns and action and gangs and crime stuff. I think that there's so much of this churned out that it's just getting a bit boring, I think. And I think that it's got to be special now to be good. And in that trailer, I didn't see any signs of this being particularly special. It just looked like more of the same. Sorry.
Yeah, well, you know, it's the other side of that. It's every now and again you discover something that's just small and unexpected, and that's what wins the day. And I love finding a little action movie like that just happens and be's great. Okay, next up is a TV series that's coming to Sky on April 30th. This is called Prisoner, and it follows a young prison officer transporting a high-value prisoner to testify against a crime syndicate, with their relationship evolving throughout their dangerous journey. It sounds a bit like that TV show Atomic that was on some time ago, but this one is more British and set in Britain and has a British cast. I thought it looked fair enough. It looked more interesting than the other dross that we get on TV here. So what did you think of this?
Yeah, I had, first of all, when I watched the trailer, I thought it's just more of the same, this kind of action thing. But to be honest, I hadn't realised that it was a TV series. So I would certainly give this more of a chance. It does look as though there's more about it than the first one, and it's frightfully British.
All right. Well, at the other end of the spectrum from Dirty Hands, maybe I should have put these together. That probably would have been intelligent, but I'm not intelligent, so it didn't happen. Coming to theatres on September the 11th is a big action movie, and this one...
Not another one.
going to be one of those tentpole summer action films that Arnold Schwarzenegger or Sylvester Stallone used to make back in the 80s and 90s. It's called Runner, and it stars Alan Richardson and Owen Wilson. Reacher is the star. It's a high-end courier, has 3 hours to transport a liver from Brisbane to the Gold Coast. It's not coming until September the 11th, actually.
Oh,
I
good.
Noticed. I thought it was just in the middle of the summer. But, yeah, it looks good fun. It looks like it's got money. It looks like it's got thrills. And you hate it.
The trailer just makes it look more of the same kind of action thing. They've put some human interest in the middle of this story because of it, they've got to get this organ to where it's going, but then it turns into this just like this macho man action thing again. It's more of the same to me, I'm afraid.
Oh dear, poor Ted. He has to tolerate all these action movies. Right, Passenger is up next, and this is a horror film that's arriving in theatres on May 22nd, and this is about a young couple who witness a gruesome highway accident. They soon realise that they did not leave the crash scene alone. A demonic presence called the Passenger won't stop until it claims them both. It looks a little generic initially, but whenever you watch the trailer, I think it looks like it could be something that's going to be a wee bit more memorable than other horror films out at the moment, because there's so many. And you know, Ted, it's just another horror film. It's just generic, isn't it?
Yeah, of course it is. But it looks more intelligent, this. It looks more interesting. And, you know, it looks like it's a mystery, thriller, drama, horror kind of thing. This is much more appealing to me than some Rambo character with their gun shooting the shit out of everyone, you know? It just looks smart and interesting and intelligent. Sorry.
No, I'm with you. I'll happily watch this all the way to Runner. Yeah. Next up is a little bit of a change of pace for the trailers here, and it's got beer in it. It's called The Last One for the Road, and it's about two blustery 50-somethings who have an obsession going for their last drink. One night, they run into Gualo, a shy architect student whose way of seeing the world would love to be transformed as the trio wander from bar to bar in Veneto. Veneto? Veneto.
Is that in Italy?
It's in Italy, yeah. Yeah, right. It is. Yeah. This is a little comedy road trip movie. Set in Italy, about a bunch of aging people going from pub to pub. What do you think?
I thought this looked really good fun. And as you know, I don't normally go for comedies, but this trailer just has something about it. It looked interesting and funny. And it looked like I was expecting Mads Mikkelsen to turn up any minute. Some of those comedies from, you know, Scandinavia that he's kind of been involved in, it had that feel about it, this kind of European comedy thing. And, yeah, I'm up for that. I shall look forward to it.
Yeah, it does look rather good. Mm-hmm. And finally, a new sci-fi action thriller about dinosaurs is coming, and it's finally got its name. The End of Oak Street. After a mysterious cosmic event rips Oak Street and suburbia and transports their neighbourhood to some place unknown, the Platt family soon discovers that their very survival depends on them sticking together as they navigate their now unrecognisable surroundings. This is the newest film from J.J. Abrahams, and he assures us this is nothing to do with Cloverfield, although it certainly feels like it does. And it stars Ewan McGregor, Anne Hathaway, Chris Coy, and there's other people in the cast as well, surprisingly. What did you make of this?
Until I watched this the second time, I hadn't noticed that there was a dinosaur in it. just at the last minute, you see this kind of tail of a dinosaur, and I thought, oh, that's what it's about. But even before I'd seen that, I thought this looks really spooky and mysterious, and I thought it looked great. And I like Ewan McGregor as well. And I thought you probably like this because it's set in 1980s America. I think that this would be my pick of the bunch, to be honest. It looks really interesting.
Well, you can look forward to it on August 14th. It says it was produced by J.J. Abrams. Sorry, did I say it was directed by J.J.?
No, you didn't.
Directed by David Mitchell.
Yeah.
No, not that David Mitchell. David Robert Mitchell. The one who directed Under the Silver Lake and It Follows.
It had this kind of real 1980s feel about it, though. You could see. They've done something with the lighting and the. It's almost like sepia toning or something, and it just had this kind of 1980s feel about it. The trailer just made it look as though it was quite well produced to me, and I shall look forward to that.
Okay. All right.
The final curtain. Right. Two people that have not made it through, one of which we should have done on the last show, shouldn't we?
We did. I actually clocked it the day we did the last show, and it didn't connect with me. But yes, James Tolkien passed away, who, well, we're slackers, Ted. We're slackers. He played the principal in Back to the Future, whose name I've now forgotten, and also Maverick's training officer in Top Gun. I also know him from Bone Tomahawk, which is a surprisingly brilliant horror western with Kurt Russell. And he's popped up in a load of films. There was a little TV movie with Jeff Fahey he was in called Sketch Artist that was well done too. Strickland, that's his name, Principal Strickland.
Right.
You would come back to me. Obviously, you know James Tolkien as well?
Principally from his role in a Woody Allen film, Love and Death. And I would never have known his name, but looking back now, I see that he was playing that in Love and Death, and it was really funny. He was playing Napoleon. And he did a good job. War Games.
He has hair in it.
Sorry?
He has hair in it. I've never actually seen him with hair.
Ah, right. It might be a wig.
It could be, sorry. Yeah. Okay.
War Games. Did you mention War Games?
No, I don't remember him in that.
Oh, right. No, nor do I particularly. But I certainly have watched War Games about half a dozen times in my life because for a 1983 film, and unlike me usually, for some reason I hooked onto that and I really liked War Games and watched it again and again and again, as previously described.
Yeah, back in the early 80s, late 70s, made a lot of good films, but I can't quite remember them. Like, I watched Prince of the City a few years ago. I picked it up on DVD whenever Blu-ray was happening, and it wasn't released on Blu-ray. I was most annoyed about that, but it was a good police procedural, but I can't quite remember him in there. And he was in Wolfen as well with Albert Finney, and the Amityville Horror as well.
Oh, right.
But he was the coroner in that, but that's probably just a role at the end of the film or something.
Right.
He was in Serpico as well, which I don't quite remember him there. And Abduction. Was that the one with Richard? No, I don't know. Abduction, maybe.
Okay. Lots of small parts, though, and clearly lots of one-off episodes in American TV, which, you know, is fair enough. And he's made a good kind of career of doing not such huge things. But it's still notable, so it's very sad. And he was 94.
Yeah. Robo Warriors. I watched that with Alan quite recently. Yeah, it was really good. really good, actually. Yeah, that was the third film in the... There's Robot Wars, Robot Jocks, and then Robot Warriors, and Crash and Burn as well. But we were really surprised by how quality that film was. But again, I don't remember him in it, but it starred James Remar.
Weren't we talking about Serpico as well, with Alan? Serpico. In 1973, about this New York cop called Serpico, who is a whistleblower. I'm sure that Alan was into that film. Yeah.
Well, I know that Alan likes to walk around town pretending to be Serpico. If he's listening to this, he's going to give me a cheeky little punch in the chops. I don't remember him Serpico at all.
Right. Perhaps it was again. Anyway, I don't know. But anyway, yeah.
Okay. Next up, we have. I missed this as well the other day. It was on the 8th of April that Mario Adorf passed away, and I've mentioned him a good few times on this show because I know I reviewed the Caliber 9 Italian Connection and The Boss on here, and I also waxed lyrical about Deadlock when I saw it because I'd never quite seen anything like it. Mario Adorf was a phenomenal actor. He was a German actor who moved into the Italian film industry and ran circles around it. He was just phenomenal. He has a very unique look to him where he's kind of got he's got a very large head with a very large chin. But he played all of these very bizarre characters. Whenever he played a goody, he would be a bad goody. Or whenever he played a baddie, he would make that baddie likable. And you cared about that character. He would play with the audience as much as he would play in the film. And for that, he's absolutely legendary. He's got hundreds of films that he appeared in, and I only know a very, very small amount. But he popped up in all kinds of films over the years. But I know him from jumping into the Polizio Testi films and immersing myself in them over the last number of years, because he was in the Execution Squad, the Italian Connection, Caliber 9, which is one of the greatest Polizio Testi thrillers out there. You might know him from The Adventures of Pinocchio, which was a miniseries. I know you like Pinocchio.
Wasn't that just the voice?
I don't know. You can tell me.
I think it was just a voice thing. I do know him from Smiller's Sense of Snow. Then, and I've spoken about this film before. He plays Captain Sigmund Lucas in this film, and it's not a huge part, but he's in there. And I do remember very, very fondly Smiller's. It's also called Smiller's Feeling for Snow, but the original title was Smiller's Sense of Snow, and that was a thriller, really, really good thriller, with Julia Ormond in it, based in the snowy kind of Scandinavian fields up north. And I've spoken about it before. Richard Harris is in it. It's a really, really good film. And yes, he was in that. Looking through the filmography, I think that's probably the only thing I can find that I'm aware of, Gareth.
Well, yeah, it's a lot of it is non-native English speaking roles, you know, in German TV shows and movies, and we don't tend to get them here. Not because we don't want them, or because we were denied them in any way. It's just it's more because we're denied them. We would get American stuff before we get anything like that. But looking through, you know, you've got Holocroft Covenant, which was John Frankenheimer. He was in that with Michael Caine. And I didn't really think too much of that film, to be honest. There was a great little thriller that I happened to notice. I think I mentioned it on my blog as well. That was What Have They Done With Our Daughters? Which is a great Polizio Testi kidnap thriller. It's shocking. It's one of those really kind of hard to stomach ones. No, it's not terribly hard to stomach. It's just a cut above what you might expect from a tough thriller. So it's worth going and investigating his filmography and see if you can dig out some of those highlights. And if you watch anything, I'd really say go with the Caliber 9 and the Italian Connection, because those two are fantastic. And then if you can find it, Deadlock. When I watched that, I went straight online and picked up the rather expensive 4K because I needed to have it in the event that I ever want to watch it again, because it's such a good film.
It's an incredible filmography. If you scroll through it, right back to 1954, and he was just never not doing anything. Every single year, he was involved in multiple projects. You know, four things in a year, or five things, or six things in a year. Just never not working. And I mean, I personally probably have heard of about 2% of them, but you know, the man's clearly a workaholic, and worthy of checking out, as you say.
Well, he was doing what he loved.
Yeah, he couldn't have had time for anything else.
True.
Pygmalion, Pinocchio. That's a mini TC. Right, he played Geppetto in Pinocchio. I think, yeah, it's an animation. It was his voice. Yeah, that's right. He was... Oh, no, hang on a minute. He is there. I've seen a picture in IMDb now as Geppetto. And it is... Geppetto is real person in it. So he was in that. I don't believe I've seen that that version of it. When's that? 2013. It's a mini TV series. So it's not a film.
No.
Interesting. We can see if we can track that down on some streaming service. I'd like to watch that. Anyway. There you go. Mario Adorf and James Tolkien, who didn't make it through the fortnight. We're about done now. Shortest show this time compared to normal. Just the reminders, GarethMiles.com is where you'll find Gareth and his lovely film reviews. TedSalmon.com is where you'll find all I do, and the podcasts that we're involved in and the other MeWe groups and all the rest of it. If you get lost, it's all on Podhub UK. And our website is projectorroom.co.uk, and you can catch us there and all the links we've been talking about. So yeah, we'll see you on MeWe, hopefully. And do join us again next time in the Projector Room.